Hey there, my fellow thriver, and welcome back to the Trauma Mama podcast, where we talk about what trauma is, how it happens, how it affects our brains, behaviors, and relationships, and most importantly, what we can do about it. I'm your host and Trauma Mama, Alexandra Pratt. Happy New Year. It's 2020. So, what are your intentions for the new year? Have you reflected on that yet? I have a few goals myself, and I try to make them obtainable and realistic, but also in ways that push myself. To get these goals, I'll need to work hard. And over the last decade, I feel like I've spent a lot of my time, effort, money, and energy into my recovery. I've spent a lot of time feeling too depressed to work towards things that I love and am passionate about. So I'm excited to have the motivation and turn my focus towards these new goals. It's all about trying. It's all about doing. In our last episode, we talked about reactions that happen to our brains and bodies during trauma. So today, we're going to talk about what happens after trauma, those long-term effects. Not only do you feel differently, you experience and process life differently. Because of the trauma, your brain chemistry is different, and that has lasting impacts. One of the most immediate things that happens after trauma is that we tend to re-experience it, and this can happen in a few different ways. It can happen through replaying the trauma, through nightmares, and through flashbacks. So firstly, let's talk about what it means to replay a memory. Many people find that the mind returns over and over to this upsetting experience and the memories that it holds, as almost if it's on a loop. It may be our brain's way of trying to make sense of what happened, to figure it out and resolve it so that we can move on. Whatever the cause, it can be extremely distressing to relive these traumatic experiences over and over. And even if we try our best to get the memory out of our heads, something in the now and here will remind us of the memory, and it shoots us right back. So something I've learned while practicing mindfulness is that pushing away the thought is not always helpful, that it actually can help to allow the thoughts to come, to experience the emotion. The less we avoid it, the less it builds up and festers. If we allow ourselves to process the feelings and sensations these reminders cause, our emotional response will decrease over time. Another way we re-experience the trauma is through nightmares. And while the actual experience probably felt like a nightmare, it's common for real nightmares to haunt our dreams in the aftermath. The nervous system has taken major shock, and even in our sleeping hours, the brain continues to process the event. Most of the time, the nightmares aren't exactly the experience we had, but there can be some common themes. Themes like betrayal, danger, dread, fear, sadness, rejection. And not surprisingly, these nightmares can contribute to poor sleep, and that's a very common side effect after trauma. And then lastly, we can replay traumatic events through flashbacks. It's a little bit different than replaying it in your mind. A flashback can happen unexpectedly and out of nowhere, and suddenly in your mind's eye, you're looking at that event, at the person, at the room, wherever it happened. You can still see what's in front of you in real life now, but for some reason, this image seems so real as well as it appears in your mind. And flashback occurs when the traumatic memory is queued up. You're feeling prompted. I don't like to say triggered because that word itself can be quote unquote triggering. So instead we say prompting because this reminder can prompt this emotional reaction. And these flashbacks are so upsetting and uncomfortable because they bring back a flood of emotions and vivid memories and actual physical feelings. For me, it can happen when I see or hear something that reminds me of the trauma. And then suddenly, I'm consumed by the visions of painful events in my head. A surge of emotions and instant physical reactions take a hold of me. I can get through it. Recently, I was watching a movie with a graphic scene that definitely prompted a few flashbacks for me. It was really hard to keep watching the movie, to sit there and tolerate it. But I did. I shaked and trembled. It was hard to catch my breath as my heart raced and I started to cry. Even though I was telling my cognitive self that it's okay, I didn't have to freak out, my body still did. I didn't turn the movie off. I did close my eyes, but I listened and occasionally peeked. Because if I turn the movie off, I'm telling my brain that I can't handle it. I'm reinforcing that fear. So I powered through until my reaction came down, until I was calm again. It was very uncomfortable, but the more I pushed through to tolerate, the less of a grip these flashbacks will have on me. You know, we can feel flashbacks to painful memories and traumatic memories, but now we can also feel it towards newer, fresher wounds that aren't really traumatic. We find that this pain is storing itself in a very similar way in the brain. It can cause very intense and uncomfortable dread that can last for minutes, hours, or what seems even days. And these flashbacks can instantly ruin a moment if we go down the path that they are revealing to us. But there's a larger and more chronic effect of trauma that's known as emotional dysregulation, meaning we have difficulty controlling and maintaining our emotions. We have really intense and often disproportional reactions to emotions such as anger, anxiety, sadness, and shame. And when trauma occurs at a young age, this emotional dysregulation stays with you as an ongoing pattern. But if the trauma has happened to you when you're older, while you had already been functioning well before the trauma, this emotional dysregulation is usually temporary and short-lived. So, what are the dysregulated emotions typically associated with trauma? It's fear, anxiety, anger, sadness, guilt, and feeling numb. Fear and anxiety is perhaps the most common emotional reaction to trauma. And it makes perfect sense that we would be afraid of something after something scary happened to us. And in fact, like so many of these reactions, it's a sign that our nervous system is functioning as it should. Nevertheless, the fear following a trauma can be as bad or worse than the emotions that we felt at that time. And it most certainly lasts longer. You may feel like the fear is finally subsiding when, out of nowhere, something prompts you and that intense fear returns. Or you may be afraid of things that you weren't before and just constantly feel uneasy. Anger. In addition to fear and anxiety, anger is very common after trauma. We might feel angry at the person or situation responsible for the trauma. And we might even be angry at ourselves if we blame ourselves for what happened. We might be more irritable than usual and have a hard time understanding why we're snapping at our partners and coworkers and friends or family. We might be less patient. And like all of these reactions, it's perfectly normal to feel anger. And sadness. We often will feel perpetually sad and cry after a highly traumatic event. And, you know, crying is actually helpful for the body. It can be a way for the nervous system to calm down from the fight, flight, freeze, or fawn response. Because Crying is associated with the parasympathetic nervous system, which is responsible for calming the mind and the body. And the sadness can also come from feeling alone, rejected, betrayed, or overwhelmed by a world that feels terribly threatening now. Sadness and grief are also really common, especially when the trauma involved the loss of someone close to us. And it's normal for these feelings of sadness to wax and wane, to come and go, just as you thought you were getting out of that depression, you find yourself sliding back in. Another emotion that we struggle with after trauma is guilt. Excessive and often inappropriate feelings of guilt is also very common. It can be a way that our minds cognitively try to make sense and gain control over the traumatic experience. We might feel responsible for being attacked or hurt, as though somehow we caused it. I find that I am often very quick to assume that the negative situation or negative emotion I see someone else experience is my fault. Maybe because it's easier to blame myself, because I can control myself and maybe fix the problem or fix myself if I am the problem. But I am often quite wrong about this. Most of it is not my fault at all, and I just assume this responsibility for it. There's also this thing called survival's guilt, when you feel really undeserving to have survived because others did not. Sometimes combat veterans feel very guilty about actions that they took in the course of their duties that resulted in death or injury. Or sometimes we might not feel any of these emotions at all. We might not feel anger, fear, and anxiety, or sadness, or guilt, because we just feel numb. Sometimes, rather than feeling strong emotions, we shut down emotions altogether. It's a way to cope. And sometimes our body does it without us even realizing it. But the sad thing is about this is when you shut out the negative feelings, we also shut out the good feelings. We may no longer take interest or enjoy things that used to bring us pleasure. We might not have the positive emotions we know we should be having when something good happens in our lives. Part of the numbing response can come from a self-protective effort in the face of overwhelming emotions, but the problem is sometimes we don't know how to turn it off and turn the emotions back on. So that's how trauma can affect our emotions in the long term. It can cause dysregulation, and that causes difficulty with our daily lives, trying to navigate relationships and situations that are stressful, scary, hurtful, frustrating. When you're dysregulated, you can't really cope effectively, and those daily emotions that we have to experience in life can become very overwhelming and hard to maintain functionality through. We may not be able to do the things we need to do to take care of ourselves and take care of our relationships. So let's talk about how trauma can affect our behaviors in the future. First and foremost, it can cause avoidance. Sometimes we feel it's easier to just avoid things related to the trauma. You know, because by definition, a traumatic event is not a pleasant memory. So it makes sense that we would want to avoid thinking about it. And sometimes that turns into avoiding people, places, or things that remind us of the painful memory. For example, we might avoid TV shows that remind us of the event or person. Other times, we might avoid things because they feel dangerous, like a section of a city where the assault happened. These things make sense, right? But the thing I've learned about avoidance is that it often grows. It starts with avoiding things that remind us of the painful memory, but then we can start to avoid other aspects of our lives that help us to be self-sufficient and effective and functional. We can even avoid things that are important parts of taking care of ourselves. And I've been there. And sometimes we don't even realize we're doing it. For example, I used to avoid sharp knives. I didn't really realize it until I was cooking with someone and they asked me where my knives were for chopping up vegetables, and I realized I didn't even really have anything but a steak knife, and that I didn't chop things or cut things. And that was a fear, driven by trauma. So I had to learn how to embrace it and lean into it and get through it by using knives. Now I chop vegetables all the time, very effectively. But things that don't make sense sometimes start to happen, like avoiding making a phone call about a car appointment. The simplest little task, all you have to do is just pick up the phone and call, but for some reason, you just don't do it. Or you don't open your mail. You don't look at your phone. You stop talking to that one person. You just don't know even how to approach it, so you don't. Avoiding things is not how we work through it. It's not how we grow and move forward to the things that we want to achieve in life. Putting things off is one thing, but avoiding them altogether is another. And that's the one we want to watch out for. Another behavior that typically is associated with the aftermath and long-term effects of trauma is substance abuse and compulsions. I'm putting them in there in the same category because the root of those two behaviors is addiction. Self-medication and substance abuse are ways that traumatized people use to gain control of their emotions or numb them. But ultimately, using substances can further cause and drive the emotional dysregulation that we experience. But it's not just substance abuse, it's compulsions that can also be very harmful. Engaging in high risk or self-injurious behaviors, eating disorders, compulsive habits, gambling, overworking, or repressing and denying your emotions altogether. These are things we need to be very careful of indulging in, because they can lead to a very slippery slope that drives us further into emotional dysregulation, which is uncomfortable and ineffective, and we'd really rather not be down there anymore. We want that pain to go away, right? So I'd like to mention that there are many other ways to create patterns of positive self-regulation, such as mindfulness. That's key, that underlies every skill that I've learned to cope with, is mindfulness. It's my most effective tool. Other healthy ways can be finding creative and even industrious ways to manage these difficult emotions through physical activity, by creating art, writing, playing music, investing time into a hobby or a passion, or learning something new, being outside. That's a really great way to heal, is to take in the beauty of nature and to be mindful of your senses and in the present moment with the ocean or the mountain or the stars or the field, or even just your front porch step. Another behavior we can experience after trauma is difficulty sleeping. Sleep is a very vulnerable state, and when the body and brain are all revved up and hyper-aroused, like we tend to be after trauma, it's likely we have a hard time sleeping. It's as if the mind is saying, don't fall asleep, danger, this is no time to sleep. Or maybe we don't even want to fall asleep because we have nightmares, and that interferes with our restful REM cycle because we wake up in so much stress. It can make us really reluctant to go to bed. Sometimes I have these nights where, like, the hardest thing for me is just to lay down. I want to keep moving, cleaning, organizing, working on my craft, doing whatever I'm doing. The idea of laying down and relaxing actually seems difficult sometimes. Something else that can happen to our behaviors is the loss of interest in sex. As with sleep, the brain may be very inclined to avoid sexual activity following the trauma. And it's easy to understand, especially if the trauma was a sexual assault, and sexual activity triggers painful memories of the attack. But even if the trauma was not sexual in nature, we may be less interested as we recover from something. We may not even want to be touched. So we've talked about how trauma can affect our emotions and our behaviors in the long term. Let's talk about how it affects our cognitions, our thoughts. So I'm going to talk about some examples of how our thought processes can change after experiencing traumatic stress. We can have intrusive thoughts and memories. Experiencing without warning or desire thoughts and memories that are associated with the trauma. These intrusive thoughts and memories can be easily triggered and cause strong emotional and behavioral reactions as if the trauma was reoccurring in the present. They can come so rapidly as if they're flooding in and take over in a split second, and this can be very disruptive to the situation at hand. If you're driving or at work or talking to your partner, it can derail the moment very quickly. If you experience a trigger, it may last longer than just a moment. It may send you back into an emotional and physical spiral of discomfort and pain. Trauma can also change how we view the world and ourselves. We can have difficulty trusting people. When we've been attacked, abused, or betrayed by another person, it can be very hard to know who to trust, especially if we were caught off guard with it. Or even if it happened over a long period of time, we may question everything. We might start to suspect everyone, feeling like, if that person could hurt me, why won't this person? If that situation was dangerous, why won't this one be? You may wall yourself up from others, isolate yourself to keep yourself safe. You may have thoughts that the world is now extremely dangerous, especially immediately after trauma. The mind is likely to see the world as a very dangerous place. Whereas before, we might have underestimated the danger in a situation. Now, after trauma, we might overestimate it. And misinterpreting a current situation as dangerous because it somewhat resembles or reminds us of a previous trauma can cause a lot of disruption in our daily life and make it difficult for us to get through normal stressors and pain that we're going to have to experience as we move forward in life. For example, someone might now overreact to an overturned canoe and 8 inches of water, as if they would drown, maybe because they've experienced nearly drowning before in a rip current. So even the slightest memory of that, the tipping of the canoe, even though they could stand in the shallow water, it could trigger such a visceral reaction, which would take time to come down from. However, over time, our beliefs can shift back toward the middle, and we can learn to recognize that the world can be dangerous at times, but also can be very safe. We can learn how to tell the difference, how to realize what's actually a threat and what's not. We might also have thoughts of blame, blaming ourselves for the trauma. As I talked about earlier, it's very common to feel guilty after something terrible happens to you, as though you're to blame for it. You may think about ways that you could have avoided the trauma. You might tell yourself, if only I'd left work a few minutes earlier. I shouldn't have bit out at that time. I should have seen that he was coming for me. Why wasn't I more careful? Why didn't I get this person help sooner? It leads to thoughts of thinking that you should have handled the trauma differently. So many survivors think they should have had a different response in the moment. I know that I've had those thoughts myself. Second-guessing the split-second decisions that we had to make under a high degree of stress. We can perhaps think of a better reaction when we have hours and days to mull it over, but life is lived in real time, and we did what we needed to in order to survive. It's easy to use the advantage of hindsight to see the mistake or mistakes that we think we have made that caused this trauma, when in reality we are likely to be overstating our own responsibility for this event. And the result is that unnecessary guilt and shame that we carry with ourselves into future situations and relationships. All the same, thinking these things is normal after trauma. It's okay. We can work through these thoughts and get to more positive and constructive mindsets. Some other thoughts you might have after trauma is seeing yourself as weak or inadequate or less than in some way, telling yourself that you let it happen or you deserved it. I remember thinking that if I was better, smarter, more beautiful, more fun, not in the way, certain things would have been different. I used to tell myself that they wouldn't have hurt me or themselves. But that's just simply not true. There's nothing that I did that caused it. We have thoughts of criticizing the way we reacted to the trauma. So in addition to beating ourselves up for having experienced it in the first place, we might also be upset with ourselves for even being upset. As one person once said to me, how come everyone else has gotten over it and I can't? And there's such an irony in how common it is to believe that after trauma, nobody else would have had the same struggles that I'm having now. I'm alone in this. But so many people feel this way. And as with these trauma-related thoughts, we're often way more critical of ourselves than we need to be. We need to allow ourselves to have these thoughts, understand where these thoughts come from. Every emotion and thought has a prompting event, something that caused it. So let's pay attention to that. Let's listen to that. Not judge it or label it with a negative qualifier, but just label it for what it is. I'm feeling guilty. I'm feeling bad about myself. I'm feeling not good enough. And it makes sense because this happened and that wasn't fair. But it's okay to feel these things. It makes sense. We need to change our inner dialogue to these statements of awareness and validation. Something else that can happen to our thoughts is quite extreme. We can have hallucinations even, and delusions. And although they are a biological origin, it can contain thoughts that are congruent with trauma content. For example, a woman stepping onto a bus sees a person that she thinks is her father, who had abused her, so she gets off the bus. But really, it's just a man who happened to be wearing the same pair of shoes that her dad used to have. But in the moment she saw him, right, she had this hallucination or delusion because her fear is so powerful. Trauma can cause something I've mentioned before called disassociation, which is related to depersonalization, derealization, and it's a mental process that severs off connections with people's thoughts, memories, feelings, actions, or even sense of identity. And most of us have experienced disassociation at some point in our life, losing the ability to recall or track a particular action. Even as simple as arriving at work but not remembering the drive. We were just in autopilot. Disassociation happens because the person is engaged in an automatic activity and is not paying attention to the immediate environment. And during the extreme stress, it was a way to sever the connection and pain that those events caused. So the body went into automatic activity, not paying attention, as a way to protect ourselves from these intense emotions flooding us. It helps distance us from the experience, from the individual who caused it, from the memories. But in turn, disassociating can also distance us from ourselves. And that's not something we want to do, because being aware of ourself, our body, our mind, our emotions is very important for recovery and finding peace and happiness within ourselves that is not dependent on anything external. This is something that we can cultivate, but we need to be in touch and very aware, even when it's difficult and unpleasant. But we need to stay very in touch with ourselves to do that. It's something we practice and cultivate. Disassociation can range from mild to a severe symptomatic disorder, such as dissociative identity disorder, also known as multiple personality disorder. According to the DSM-5, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, dissociative disorders are characterized by a disruption or discontinuity in the normal integration of consciousness, memory, identity, emotion, perception, body representation, motor control, and behavior. These diagnoses are often associated with histories of severe childhood trauma or pervasive human-caused intentional trauma, such as experiences from concentration camps or victims of ongoing political imprisonment, torture, or long-term isolation. The person may not even remember what actually happened, while emotions experienced during the trauma may be re-experienced, the person might not understand why. And that's something that we'll discuss in future episodes. called a repressed memory. So we've talked about how trauma affects our emotions, behaviors, and even our thoughts. But how does it affect our bodies long term? First and foremost, it creates a very hyperactive nervous system, and we can live in a physical state called hyperarousal. And what does that feel like? Feeling constantly on edge and on guard. Because when the nervous system has had a terrifying shock, it doesn't immediately settle down. It may not be able to turn off that high alert that it was forced to turn on during the high stress. It'll be turned up for a while, ready for the possibility of future danger. You might keep looking over your shoulder, constantly scanning your surroundings for threats. You've been hurt before, and you don't want to be caught off guard again. And it means your brain is trying to do its job to protect you. But that level of high alertness is not always necessary or effective. Our bodies can be easily startled when we're stuck in this hyperarousal state. Things like slamming a door, someone knocking on a door, fireworks, the touch of a hand on your shoulder. You can find that you're jumpier than you used to be, and maybe it takes longer for you to come back down to a baseline after feeling scared or sad or angry or startled. So how do we know how trauma really affects our bodies and our brains? In the 1990s, a gigantic multi-million dollar machine was developed. Based on advanced physics and computer technology, it rapidly made neuroscience into a popular area of research. This machine is called the fMRI, which stands for Functional Magnetic Resonance Imaging. And it enabled scientists for the first time to visualize how different parts of the brain are activated or deactivated when people are engaged in certain tasks or when they remember certain events from the past. Now, with this machine, we could watch the brain as it processed memories, sensations, and emotions. We could see it on a map in the circuits of our mind and consciousness. To end this episode, I'm going to read a portion from a book called The Body Keeps Score by Bessel van der Kolk. He's an MD and the founder and medical director of the Trauma Center in Brookline, Massachusetts. He is also a professor of psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine and the director of the National Complex Trauma Treatment Network. This book really inspired me to create this podcast after reflecting on my recovery and all of the different types of therapies and approaches and books that I read. I wanted to bring this information to the public, especially the information that he wrote in this book, which is a very detailed look at the science behind trauma. Because for the first time, seeing this scientific information about what happens, I felt a lot less crazy. Like, it wasn't just in my mind that things actually happened. But it also gave me hope because he talks a lot about different forms of treatment that are effective. I highly recommend you check the book out. It's a good read. So here we go. Let's dive into this portion that really shows how the fMRIs can really map different patterns and activation and deactivation of different parts of our brains. At this first session, we explain the purpose of the radioactive oxygen the participants would be breathing. As any part of the brain became more or less metabolically active, its rate of oxygen consumption would immediately change, which would be picked up by the scanner. We would monitor their blood pressure and heart rate through the procedure, so that these physiological signs can be compared with the brain activity. Several days later, the participants came into the imaging lab. Marcia, a 43-year-old teacher from a suburb outside of Boston, was the first volunteer to be scanned. Her script took her back to the day, 13 years earlier, when she picked up her 5-year-old daughter, Melissa, from camp. As they drove off, Marcia heard a persistent beeping indicating Melissa's seatbelt was not properly fastened. When Marcia reached over to adjust the belt, she ran a red light. Another car smashed into hers from the right, instantly killing her daughter. In the ambulance, on the way to the emergency room, the 7-month-old fetus Marcia was carrying also died. Overnight, Marcia had changed from a cheerful woman who was the life of the party into a haunted and depressed person, filled with self-blame. She moved from classroom teaching into school administration because working directly with children had become intolerable. As for many parents who have lost children, their happy laughter has become a powerful trigger. Even hiding behind her paperwork, she could barely make it through the day. In a futile attempt to keep her feelings at bay, she coped by working day and night. I was standing outside the scanner as Marcia underwent the procedure and could follow her physiological reactions on a monitor. The moment we turned on the tape recorder, her heart started to race and her blood pressure jumped. Simply hearing the script activated the same physiological responses that had occurred during the accident 13 years earlier. After the recorded script concluded and Marcia's heart rate and blood pressure returned to normal, we played her second script, getting out of bed and brushing her teeth. This time, her heart rate and blood pressure did not change. As she emerged from the scanner, Marcia looked defeated, drawn out and frozen. Her breathing was shallow, her eyes were open wide, and her shoulders were haunched. The very image of vulnerability and defenselessness. We tried to comfort her, but I wonder if whatever we discovered would be worth the price of her distress. After all 8 participants completed the procedure, Scott Roch went right to work with his mathematicians to create composite images that compared the arousal created by a flashback with the brain in neutral. After a few weeks, he sent me the results, which you see above. I taped the scans up on the refrigerator in my kitchen, and for the next few months I stared at them every evening. It occurred to me that this is exactly how early astronomers must have felt when they peered through the telescope at a new constellation. There were some puzzling dots and colors on the scan, but the biggest area of the brain activation, a large red spot in the right lower center of the brain, which is the limbic area, or emotional brain, came as no surprise. It was already well known that intense emotions activate the limbic system, in particular an area within it called the amygdala. We depend on the amygdala to warn us of impending danger and to activate the body's stress response. Our study clearly showed that when traumatized people are presented with images, sounds, or thoughts related to their particular experience, the amygdala reacts with alarm, even as in Marcia's case, 13 years after the event. Activation of this fear center triggers the cascade of stress hormones and nerve impulses that drive up blood pressure, heart rate, and oxygen intake, preparing the body for fight or flight. The monitors attached to Martha's arms recorded this physiological state of frantic arousal, even though she totally never lost track of the fact that she was resting quietly in the scanner. Our most surprising finding was a white spot in the left frontal lobe of the cortex, in a region called Broca's area. In this case, the change in color meant that there was a significant decrease in that part of the brain. Broca's area is one of the speech centers of the brain, which is often affected in stroke patients when the blood supply to that region is cut off. Without a functioning Broca's area, you cannot put your thoughts and feelings into words. Our scans showed that the Broca's area went offline whenever a flashback was triggered. In other words, we have visual proof that the effects of trauma are not necessarily different from and can overlap with the effects of physical lesions like strokes. All trauma is preverbal. Shakespeare captures this state of speechless terror in Macbeth. After the murdered king's body is discovered, "Oh horror, 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 tongue nor heart cannot conceive nor name thee. Confusion now hath had made his masterpiece." Under extreme conditions, people may scream obscenities, call for their mothers, howl in terror, or simply shut down. Victims of assault and accidents sit mute and frozen in emergency rooms. Traumatized children lose their tongues and refuse to speak. Photographs of combat soldiers show hollowed eyes of men staring mutely into a void. Even years later, traumatized people often have enormous difficulty telling other people what has happened to them. Their bodies re-experience terror, rage, helplessness, as well as the impulse of fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. But these feelings are most impossible to articulate. Trauma by nature drives us to the edge of comprehension, cutting us off from language based on common experience or an imaginable past. This doesn't mean that people can't talk about a tragedy that has befallen them. Sooner or later, most survivors, like the veterans in Chapter 1, come up with many of what they call their cover story that offers some explanation for their symptoms and behavior for public consumption. These stories, however, rarely capture the inner truth of the experience. It is enormously difficult to organize one's traumatic experience into a coherent account, a narrative with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Even a seasoned reporter like famed CBS correspondent Ed Morrow struggled to convey the atrocities that he saw when the Nazi concentration camp Buchenwald was liberated in 1945. "I pray you believe what I have said. I reported what I saw and heard, but only part of it. For most of it, I have no words." When words fail, haunting images capture the experience and return as nightmares and flashbacks. In contrast to the deactivation of the Broca's area, another region, Brodmann's Area 19, lit up in our participants. This is a region in the visual cortex that registers images when they first enter the brain. We were surprised to see brain activation in this area so long after the original experience of trauma. Under ordinary conditions, raw images registered in Area 19 are rapidly diffused to other brain areas that interpret the meaning of what has been seen. Once again, we were witnessing a brain region rekindling as if the trauma were actually occurring. The scans also revealed that during flashbacks, our subjects' brains lit up only on the right side. Today, there's a huge body of science and popular literature about the difference between the right and left brain. Back in the early 90s, I had heard that some people had begun to divide the world between left-brainers, rational, logical people, and right-brainers, the intuitive, artistic ones. But I hadn't paid much attention to this area. However, our scans clearly showed that the images of past trauma activated the right hemisphere of the brain and deactivated the left. We now know that the two halves of the brain do speak different languages. The right is intuitive, emotional, visual, spatial, and tactual, and the left is linguistic, sequential, and analytical. While the left half of the brain does all the talking, the right half of the brain carries the music of the experience. It communicates through facial expressions and body language, and by making the sounds of love and sorrow, by singing, swearing, crying, dancing, or mimicking. The right brain is the first to develop in the womb, and it carries the nonverbal communication between mothers and their infants. We know the left hemisphere has come online when children start to understand language and learn how to speak. This enables them to name things, compare them, understand their interrelations, and begin to communicate their own unique subjective experience to others. The left and right sides of the brain also process the imprints of the past in dramatically different ways. The left brain remembers facts, statistics, and the vocabulary of events. We call on it to explain our experiences and put them in order. The right brain stores memories of sound, touch, smell, and the emotions they evoke. It reacts automatically to voices, facial features, and gestures, and places experienced in the past. What it recalls feels like the intuitive truth, the way things are. Even as we enumerate a loved one's virtues to a friend, our feelings may be more deeply stirred by how her face recalls the aunt we loved at age 4. Under ordinary circumstances, the two sides of the brain work together more or less smoothly, even in people who might have said to favor one side over the other. However, having one side or the other shut down, even temporarily, or having one side cut off entirely, as sometimes happens in early brain surgery, is disabling. Deactivation of the left hemisphere has a direct impact on the capacity to organize experience into logical sequence and to translate our shifting feelings and perceptions into words. Broca's area, which blacks out during the flashbacks, is on the left side. Without sequencing, we can't identify cause and effect, grasp the long-term effects of our actions, or create coherent plans for the future. People who are very upset sometimes say they are losing their minds. In technical terms, they are experiencing the loss of executive functioning. When something reminds traumatized people of the past, their right brain activates as if the traumatic event were happening in the present. But because their left brain is not working very well, they may not be aware that they are re-experiencing and reenacting the past. They are just as furious, terrified, enraged, ashamed, or frozen. After the emotional storm passes, they may look for something or someone to blame for it. They behaved the way they did because you were 10 minutes late, or you burned the potatoes, or you never listened to me. Of course, most of us have done this from time to time, but when we cool down, we can hopefully admit our mistake. Trauma interferes with this kind of awareness, and over time, our research demonstrated why. So that's a detailed look into mapping where trauma takes place in our brain, what is activated, what is deactivated. So that's it for today. Thanks for listening. On our next episode, we're going to go back to looking at how trauma affects the brain and what a traumatic memory is, how it's stored, and how it may be different when it happens to you as a child versus an adult. Thanks for listening. Keep thriving. You're not alone. I want to take a minute to thank the producer of our new theme song, Bay Window, a singer, songwriter, and producer from the San Francisco Bay Area. If you or someone you know is suffering and is in crisis, I recommend that you reach out to counselors at suicidepreventionlifeline.org/chat. There you can chat online with someone right away. Or you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. If you don't feel like talking on the phone, you can also text the crisis line by sending the word CONNECT in all caps to 741741. You're not alone. Thank you for listening, and keep thriving.